of Aaron Adler, Koldo D. the Fake Revisited.
Bokatov. Again, I want to thank Gilat Rinat Yisrael for inviting me for this weekend under the umbrella banner of the 70 for 70. People have counted the pictures in the ad, and they noticed that there were at least 80 pictures there of speakers, and I can tell you that 90 speakers came from were a part of this program. Not all of them came from Israel. Most did come from Israel. I mean, if you see a picture of Rav Shechter and a few others, you realize that there were some locals on board. Rabbi Harry Jachter was on board, and so on. Rabbi Goldberg from YU. But most came from Eretz Yisrael. Rabbanim, educators, public officials, journalists, and so on. People had something to say, hopefully positive, about the 70 years in Eretz Yisrael. And I think it was just a wonderful expression of connection with Am Yisrael in the Gola, which has become actually the new theme of what's happening in Eretz Yisrael. I'll just say this in one sentence, that for many, many years, Israel was on the take. People were donating all kinds of causes, which was extremely important, and the partnership of the diaspora Jewish community was always there in augmenting financial support and political support, whatever it is. And I'm not saying this has come to an end in any way or manner. I remember when Yossi Beilin, who was Shimon Peres' sidekick, I wasn't a big chassid of Beilin politically, but sometimes even Yossi Beilin said a good vart. He spoke in the Jerusalem Theater to an annual convention of Hadassah women. And he said that we're very appreciative and thankful for all the help, blah, 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 blah. He says, but I just want to mention that if all the contributions of the entire Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael would cease, it represents less than 1% of our national budget. So the country will not collapse. So Shimon Peres gave it to him over the head and said, the emes darf min erzugen, the truth you don't have to say. But the truth is, the country has matured economically to the extent that in many, many areas we've become self-sufficient. Again, the partnership is important for strengthening institutions and so on, and I think obviously it should be continued. But what Medinat Yisrael is now embarking on is turning the tables upside down and taking a peek at what's happening in Chutz La'aretz, where we in Eretz Yisrael can be of some help to Am Yisrael abroad. And it doesn't only measure in emergencies, which, that there's almost no country that has the ability in 48 hours to send over emergency help. Even a country like Turkey, and they don't particularly love us, but they've had some very, very catastrophic earthquakes, and we went and we helped and so on. I think what happened in Haiti several years ago, it was put so bluntly by not one of our best friends in the media, CNN, and the reporter was there at the field hospital. He says, I don't understand something. We're 90 miles away from Florida, and the Israelis came 5,500 miles away, and take a look what they did in 48 hours. So that's just an example. But when Sara Chinuch, the Minister of Education, decided to send $1 million to Houston, Texas, after one of the hurricanes, to help rebuild a shul and some yeshivot down there. And he said, look, we're not going to solve the problem of Houston. Obviously, it's an American issue, but it's a token showing that we in Eretz Yisrael care. And if we do have the ability, and we do have some extra resources now, and we can share it with Am Yisrael in the Gola, we should be doing it. And it's expressing now in various avenues of life, and I think this is a major change for the better. It is putting Israel on a much better position, both domestically and internationally. I was 4 years old when the Rebbe delivered the famous speech in 1956, Tavshin Tet Zayin, on Yom Ha'atzmaut, Kol Dodi Dofek. The Rebbe delivered the speech in Yiddish. He himself had the text in Hebrew in front of him, himself, and the official publications of Kol Dodi Dofek, which was one of the early printed material of the Rebbe, all appeared in Hebrew. Of late, it's appeared already in English and other languages as well. It's a manifesto of religious Zionism. It's true that many have had the opportunity, and my brother certainly did, to go to the Mizrahi conventions. And there, people went to the conventions first and foremost to hear the Rav's keynote address. Some of those drashot were printed in a Yiddish manual called Fear Drushes. By the time it came out in Hebrew, it was already Chamesh Drashot. And some of the other drashot were printed subsequently. And those two, one after the other, form a certain composite as to Rav's opinion about religious Zionism, which differs somewhat with Rav Kook's understanding and approach to Medinat Yisrael, but that's okay. But no doubt the Rav firmly placed himself in the camp of religious Zionism. And we do know that today, Rabbi Lam, at the Shloshim Hesped for the Rav in 1993, already cautioned at that time against revisionism, and let's not rewrite the Rav, who he was. Let's not make him frummer. Let's not make him less Zionist, more Zionist, whatever. Let's try our best to present the Rav as authentically as possible so that we should have a full appreciation of who he was. There are some attempts, not going to mention names now, to show that the Rav really wasn't a Groyser Tzioni. He wasn't a big Zionist. The truth of the matter is he actually would say these things occasionally. He says, you know, I'm not a Nishkan Groyser Tzionist. But having said that, that doesn't mean he didn't feel that there was a voice of a Kadosh Baruch Hu in the establishment of Medinat Yisrael, and we had to react to it. That is no question. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebracha, who my brother mentioned the shir just before, and Daf Yomi, tomorrow is his Yahrzeit, third Yahrzeit. Rav Aaron used to give a shir on Yom Yerushalayim annually in memory of the Rav, because he couldn't do it on Chol HaMoed. And the reason why he picked Yom Yerushalayim is because it was his birthday, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's birthday, Kofres Iyar. So he delivered it every year. And he would always invite somebody else to give the shir, and then he would give a shir. So 1 year, he actually attacked those who came out very, very forcefully that the Rav was against this and he was against that and so on. And Rav Aaron felt that there's room here to put aside and put to rest all of these false impressions and a new Rav has emerged. And that's something we have to be careful about. Now, I say Kol Dodi Dofek was a speech that was given in a particular time context, 8 years after the Medina was established, 15 years after the Shoah. And if you were there, you know, you felt all that. It was very much linked to a historic moment. And the question is, what relevance is such a speech today, so many years later? I put down on the source sheet the Gemara in Masechet Megillah, Tonu Rabbanan, 48 Nevi'im, v'sheva Nevi'ot, nitnabu levehem Yisrael. There were 48 prophets, male prophets, men, 7 women prophets. V'lo patchu v'lo otiru al ma shekatuv b'Torah chutz mimigrat Megillah. We're not going to deal with the issue of Bal Tosif, which is really the halachic issue that the Gemara is talking about. But that's all? There were only 55 prophets? We talk about Kufat Nevi'im, boils down to 55. When you read Tanakh, you read about big numbers, 50 Nevi'im, 100 Nevi'im, nameless, anonymous prophets. So who are the prophets? And why does the Gemara tell us there were 48 plus 7? So the Rambam in source number 2, in Hilchot Yesoder Torah, where he deals with prophecy, he tells us something very remarkable, that there are different levels of being a Navi. So the lowest level of being a Navi is that a person has a perception of a Kadosh Baruch Hu coming in direct contact with him. That's all it is. There's no message. There's no speech to be made. Certainly no book to be written. The person has a perception of absolute finality, that a Kadosh Baruch Hu was there and has communicated something of his essence, and that's it. That is a notch above what Reb Chaim Volozhin would write in the Nefesh HaChaim of Torah Lishma. So we just heard that whole shiur about Lishma. But and Rabbi Lamb wrote a whole doctoral dissertation on the Nefesh HaChaim's definition of Torah Lishma. And the highest plateau that we can reach today spiritually is Torah Lishma, says Reb Chaim Volozhin. But there's a notch above that, and that's Nevuah, prophecy. And the lowest level of Nevuah is just to be aware that and perceive that there was some contact with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And your knowing of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's being is greater than it ever was before that contact was made. That's level one. Level two is beyond that. And now a Kadosh Baruch Hu, with this type of communication, has something to say to you privately. It's a message. And the next level is he has something to say to you and to the community of his generation. The highest level is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has something to say to the Navi, not only relevant for his community and generation, but for generations to come. And that's where the 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'ot play a role, because they're part of Kitvei HaKodesh. So there were 55 Nevi'im who have something to say to us today. And that's why it's relevant to read Yeshayahu, Yechezkel, Yirmiyahu, and so on. That's the relevance. But what about the relevance of the others? Not, as we say in Hebrew, lo relevanti, not relevant, finished. So there were Nevi'im, that's not a question. And that's what he says, and Avi Efshar Shetir Nevoto La'atzmo, and he says, Eshar Sheishlocha La'am Me'amei Ha'aretz, a local concern, but it's not, doesn't it not concern us for generations to come? But the 48, they did. And that's source number three, Tanu Rabbanan, Sidran Shal Nevi'im Baba Batra, Yeshua, Shoytim, Shmuel, Malachim, and so on. This is the Seder of the Chavdalet, the 24 books. That's what's part of Kitvei HaKodesh. In the context of Kol Dodi Dafek, the Rav puts us on a little bit of a mindset of Megillat Esther. Now, he once gave a shiur back in 1971, The Yard Side of His Wife, that was entitled, comes from the Gemara in source number four, Megillah Nikret Sefer V'Nikret Igeret. Right? I'm sure in Rinat you've heard this shiur. I remember the Rav saying that Igeret, there are two psukim in Megillat Esther. It says Igeret, and then it says V'Nichtav B'Sefer. So the book itself nicknames itself once as a Sefer, once as an Igeret. And the Rav said Igeret is like a newspaper. It's not an aerogram. It's a newspaper. What's the relevance of a newspaper? It has some relevance today. Tomorrow you can wrap fish with it. And that's it. There's no relevance any longer. The news is stale. It's stale news and so on. They used to say that we had a newspaper from the Mizrahi, Hatzofeh. I said Hatzofeh Zal, because now it morphed into Makor Rishon. But, they used to say that a lot of people read Hatzofeh. Nobody bought it. Nobody's worth. Why? Only a few Freyerim subscribed to it. But you got it for free at the Bank Mizrahi, at the Bnei Akiva, at the Amunah Sniff. You know, they gave it out. They just gave it out. Or at any yeshiva, they would, you know, I remember he came to the Gush. And if you didn't get it, you took it from a neighbor. So a lot of people read the Hatzofeh. A very low subscription. And why did you read it? You read it because of the ads. You wanted to know, you know, who got engaged, who got married, who Loya Leinu is no longer with us. That was important to keep up with the oilum, as we say. But the news was not, that wasn't the reason you bought it. So they said that the editor of Ma'ariv, Shmuel Schnitzel v'Shalom, was a Novi, because he always knew what they're going to print in Hatzofeh in 3 days in the headline. So Igeret is of limited value, has no historic value, unless you happen to be doing a doctorate on some period. You go to the library, you look in the archives, you pick out a few old New York Times just to see what they wrote. Right? So I saw a clip once in New York Times, 1932, 33, Chavetz Chaim, 104, dies. Was he 104 years old? I don't know. But there's a clip, there's an obituary in the New York Times of the death of the Chavetz Chaim. The Sefer means something else. Sefer means it has an eternal message. So clearly, Megillat Esther was relevant to Mordechai and Esther and their generation, but it's relevant to us as well, 2,500 years later. When we talk about Midrashei Chazal, so everyone knows, if you study Medrash carefully, the Medrash, many times, especially if it's a story type of Medrash, an Agadah, it's linked to some type of historic moment. Chazal was saying something about the times. Yet we all know that it is fair game to lift it out of context and use it for homiletic and sermonic material to this very day. We had a great Rav in Borough Park who taught us homiletics at YU, Rabbi Harry Wahlberg, Zichron Lebracha, and he used to tell us in preparing a drasha, it was a takeoff of a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. He would say, "V'lo a medrash ika ella hamaisala." Don't just quote the medrash, but always make sure you have a crackerjack story that goes along, because that's what they're going to remember. That's what people are going to remember. The medrash, okay, goes in one ear, goes at the other. But the medrash is the basis of what the idea that is being conveyed. So if the Rav uses a medrash and he says a wonderful idea, does that mean that that idea was what the author of the Medrash had in mind? It makes no difference. It makes absolutely no difference. There's an eternal spark to Midrashei Chazal that lends legitimacy to using the material in future generations to come. And I believe that the Rav's writings and teachings fall into this category as well. So the Rav spoke in 1956 on Yom HaTzmaut. There weren't that many yeshivot gedolot in those days observing Yom HaTzmaut. And I don't think much has changed. I'm talking about yeshivot gvahot, you know. But Yeshiva University very proudly, you know, observes Yom HaTzmaut and so on. I just saw in one of the local Jersey newspapers an ad for YU and so on. It says, "We fly the Israeli flag 365 days a year." Okay, bezeder. They want to say something about the hashkafa of the school. So if the Rav said something in 1956 that was clearly linked to the days of preceding the Sinai campaign, there was a lot of tension going on in Israel in those days. The state was in its infant stage, literally still in diapers, and struggling economically. Food rations were still being handed out for families for milk and eggs and so on. So it was a difficult moment, no doubt. And the fear that if there's going to be another war, you know, are we going to make it like we made it, Ekshehu, miraculously, in 48-49? You know, Ein Sam Chalal Anes. Are we going to make it through another military crisis? And this, to this end, Rav is speaking now about the need to beef up the Yishuv, and it's a clear, clear call for strong aliyah. There's no question that if you read Kol Dodi Dofek, you can't miss the point. Because it says, if we don't settle the land, we're going to lose the land, and it'll be missing the opportunity. So here the Rav, you know, says what he says. Now, it was important. And if you read it in the context of 1956, it makes a lot of sense. But we're not in 1956. And the first time I revisited Kol Dodi Dofek was in 2002, Tavshin Samach Bet. What happened in Tavshin Samach Bet the year before, in my community in Ramot, we sustained two losses on the day that I describe as my most horrific day in my rabbinic career. I'm sure every Rav can put a finger on his greatest day in the Rabbanut and his most horrible day in the Rabbanut. I'll just say in a moment, my greatest day, we had a blizzard in Yerushalayim, the day of one of my congregant sons was getting married. There was no way anybody was going to get to Ramat Rachel, to the Chazanah. And we decided that day that we're going to do the wedding in our shul and somehow bring some people in and invite the whole neighborhood to the wedding. Everybody was going to bring Shabbos, hot plates and bring food and so on. The kids up, we had a wonderful wedding. A wonderful wedding. It was a great day. The most horrific day was the pigua, the terrorist bomb in the Sbarro restaurant in downtown Manhattan, downtown Yerushalayim. It was absolutely horrific. And it made it more horrific because we knew most of the people. There was a woman, a family with a lot of kids who perished, and my wife knew the woman from her line of work in audiology. And there were two 15-year-old girls from my shul who perished. Michal and Malki, Raziel and Malki Roth, Hashem Yikom Daman. And their big chait was they were sitting over pizza planning the Ezra Youth Group program for that evening. And it was supposed to be one of the guys who missed the bus, so he missed the pigua, as it was. And to deal with that in the context of the community, the families, the youth group, the schools, it was very, very, very difficult for me personally to go through it, and we had no choice. We had to do it. We had to rise to the occasion and do it. A year later, the friends of the girls in the Ezra group decided to put out a memorial sefer, and they invited various people to put in articles, and there's also biographies and some pictures. A very, very nice book that was put out by the family. The pigua was just several days after Tisha B'Av, and it's al zeh hayad aval libenu hashivena Hashem melacha v'nashuva chadesh yomenu kikedem. So it was the first time I wrote about Kol Dodi Dofek, because we had just finished a military campaign of those days in Gaza, and there was something to be said about the atmosphere. And then 7 years later, there was another occasion, and that was Tavshin Samach Tet, and now the third occasion to now take it up to this year, Tavshin Ayin Chet, and see where the basic thesis of Kol Dodi Dofek stands today in its relevancy. The Rav said that he had heard six knockings on the door. I'd just like to read just a few lines, what I think is the most dramatic part of the book, introducing the six knockings on the door. Kol Dodi Dofek lifted out Shir Shirim, as you know, and he's hearing these knockings. The Rav said 8 years ago, Be'etzem Leil Blahot Malei Zva'ot, in the midst of the atrocities of Majdanek, Treblinka, Buchenwald, in the night of gas chambers and crematoriums, in the night of Hester Panim Muchlat, absolute negation of presence of God, or at least the sensation of the presence of God, in the night that apparently the Satan was ruling supreme, and the Ra'aya, who is the Ra'aya, the beloved, the woman in the Shir HaShirim story, she's Am Yisrael, according to Rabbi Akiva, and she's turning over in pain because the Rav puts his finger on things that are ultimately responsibility, points of theological responsibility to the Catholic Church. Says, in this night, in the very aftermath of Am Yisrael just turning over in pain and in torture, shemitapcha al mishkava mitoch pirpurim v'yisurei gehenom, in the aftermath of all this, ekev hahakaot v'hadfikot v'petach haraya, Kadosh Baruch Hu's banging on the door. The Ra'aya is Atufat Evel. She's draped in clothing of mourning. Nolda Medinat Yisrael. The state was born. And the Rav here is saying, he's not talking about the political price that the UN voted for a state of Israel as a type of, the Mei Matzpun, to pay the conscience of Europeans who were bothering them. Not dealing with this at all. The Rav is trying to develop a theological lamanismacha. This is not an accident, he says, that immediately after the Shoah comes this. And as the Rav begins the article by dealing with the question of Tzadik Varalo and the story of Eov, the Rav says, we are not in any position to give answers to why all this happened to us. Eov is never told why HaKadosh Baruch Hu has him suffer, lose his wife and his fortune and his family and everything. So what's the point? So Rav shows that at the end of the day, Eov turns out to be a better product. There is something about self-improvement that occurs. Because in the beginning of the Sefer, he was self-centered, and he was concerned about his own family. But the shutters of the house were closed, and he was really not concerned with anything that went on. The Rav cites the Medrash, that Eov was one of the Yoatzim advisors to Paro, and while Yitro suggested to Paro in the Medrash, send people, then Am Yisrael out, Bilam suggested to annihilate them, Eov had no opinion. No opinion, he was neutral. He was neutral because he wasn't looking to see that there was any pain out there whatsoever. That was Eov. The end of the day, at the end of the Sefer, you see he now has contact with people who need help. He became a different person. And the Rav said that there was a need for tikkun. Now that doesn't mean we can understand why he took his wife and he took children, he took this, took that. We'll never know that. The Rav said, don't even bother. And don't even bother answering the question about the Shoah. But something we do have to know, Am Yisrael has to become a better Am Yisrael afterwards. And if it didn't, then the whole thing was really a waste. And Am Yisrael did rise to the occasion, he said, and established Medinat Yisrael to produce a higher level Am Yisrael that could become, to come out of the political entity called the state. And he puts together what he considers six knockings on the door. One is the political miracle. We'll analyze again. Political miracle. The second was the military miracle. He cites Hanukkah, Rabim Biyat Na'atim. I mean, just know the facts of the independence war. I mean, on paper, it was an impossibility. It wasn't just maybe this, maybe that. It was just impossible that we were going to win that war on paper. He said there was a theological issue with the Catholic Church. There was the issue of Jewish identity. There was the issue of Dam Yehudi Eino Hefker, that before the state, Jewish blood was very cheap on the world market, and that has changed. It's not true. It's very different. It's very different today. And the last is the opening of the doors for Am Yisrael. For 1956, the Rebbe was talking about yet Pleitim for refugees and so on. It became a Ir Miklat for Am Yisrael. So we take this one at a time. The Rebbe talks about a halakha that really is summed up with do not waste an opportunity. Lo lachmitz et hasha'ah. I remember once Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein actually spoke about this very, he subjected this section of Kol Dei Dofek under halachic analysis. And because the Rav uses halachic illustrations here of how important the detail of time becomes, whether it's Zman Tefillah and Kriyat Shema, whether it's Zman Shabbat, the difference between a Shema Shabbos and a Chal Shabbat is a fraction of a second. It says, notar in Kodshim now, learning Korbanot, you're not allowed to eat it, you can eat a korban until the morning. What does morning mean? We're not getting into the achroinu machloikis, if it's 72 minutes before that. But the minute you strike the zman, so afterwards the korban is pasul, and that's it, you can't eat it anymore. And that's called notar. It's a fraction of a second. Lo lachmitz et hasha'ah. The Rav goes on to give all kinds of midrashim to show how important this is. The most famous comes from Pesach, Ushmartem et ha-matzot, which is the source of matzah shmura. It's interesting because we get in Israel all kinds of products, imported products, and everyone is trying to outdo the frumkeit of the next. I love it. I inherited this from my brother, who inherited from our father, who inherited from our grandfather and great grandfather. We have the minig in the family. We love it. So we get this imported walnut oil from California. So Mele, it tells me on the label that it's Nokim Mechshash Shvius V'Tevel. Okay, I understand that you're not going to take off Truma, and you're telling me it's the best, finest walnuts of California. But then it says Koshel Pesach Shmura. Shmura? Shmura. It's almost like Glad Kosher eggs and so on, right? Glad Kosher Milchuk restaurant, right? I was bought in Flatbush a suit. My parents live in Flatbush. I used to come to America with a shmata because I knew my mother's going to say, go to Flatbush Avenue, go to Avenue J and buy a new suit. It was a minig. I go to the store, an Indian salesperson tells me, he takes out a suit, he said it's glatt. I didn't have a clue what he was telling me. I thought I knew it by kosher. I thought, my bar mitzvah was told us. And it says there, chalak, by Yaakov Avinu. I thought he was telling me that the wool was not hairy. I thought that he was telling me. The guy was telling me that it had sharpness testing before it came into the store. I didn't realize that. Blood suit, okay. So, Shmartem et ha-matzot. Al tikra matzot ele mitzvot. Play on the word, matzot mitzvot. Mitzvah ha-ba'al liyadcha al tacha mitzena. The exact quote is here in source number 6. Ushmartem et ha-matzot of Yoshe Amar, al tikra kein elu ushmartem et ha-mitzvot. Kederok she'ein machmitzin et ha-matzah, kach ein machmitzin et ha-mitzvah. Ele im ba mitzvah liyadcha, ase ota miyad. Perform it immediately. The popular expression is mitzvah ba liyadcha, al tacha mitzena, don't let it sour. And the Rav builds a whole thing about this, that he is concerned in 1956 of not missing the opportunity. Dosh Baruch Hu gave us an opportunity, and to use the language we use, shouldn't blow it. And he was worried. He was worried that maybe something, Am Yisrael is not going to react appropriately. So the political mess had to do with the fact that who would have expected in 1947 at the UN that this was going to pass, the partition was going to pass. It was not clear at all. The fact that the Soviet Union was going to vote together with the United States was far from a given. And it happened. Once Russia went with it, all the Soviet satellites went with it as well. But then there were some South American countries and Central American countries that we weren't sure at all were going to be with us. And it passed. And it passed. It was a really, really exciting moment. Now, we know that the Rav's uncle, the Briska Rav, my brother quoted him now in the shir upstairs, the Briska Rav was a Holocaust survivor. He lost his wife and some children there. He comes to Yerushalayim, lives out his life in Yerushalayim until 1959. He dies in Erev Yom Kippur in Tavshin Chaf. So the Rav in the hesped for his uncle, Mado Dechamidod, he says, you know, it's wrong to think that my uncle Rav Velvula was an anti-Zionist. He wasn't a pro-Zionist, but he wasn't an anti-Zionist. He said he was apolitical. He was just, he could not find a rubric in the halakha that said Medinat Yisrael. If you can't find a Rambam that talks about Hilchos Medinas Yisrael, he just couldn't, he wasn't comfortable with it, and therefore he just didn't, it wasn't there. Having said that, it was reported that after the vote in 47 for the Jewish state, the Briska Rav said, it's a shmeichel from of a basko, like a wink from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And he saw it, and he felt it. This is not something that should pass by. The fact that he did nothing about it afterwards is a different story. But there was a reaction at that moment that this is something highly unusual. But where do we stand today in terms of international recognition? So fine. So Harry Truman has a place in Gan Eden for recognizing the state 6 minutes after it was declared on Yom HaTzimut in 48. And that was also not a given. The whole State Department recommended against it and so on, as you know. But it was a mazel. Kadosh Baruch Hu planted, Eddie Jacobson, and you know, used to sell underwear together with Truman somewhere in the Midwest, and the Jewish Agency people got a hold of this guy, and had him go to the White House, and the quote is Harry for all time's sakes, and Truman does it, because he's got a buddy, a former business partner, and he says I'm a taiva. Sure, all right, beseder, you know. And this is against company policy, the United States. They recognized the State of Israel. That, of course, kicked in. Many other countries following suit. But where do we stand today? We stand today, we have never been in a better international situation. So it's true that UN will certainly condemn us. I mean, they have nothing to say about Syria. Everything in Syria is Glatt Kush, everything's Pesed de Gamur, you know, nothing. They can't even make a resolution to even think about chemical welfare. They're goonish, everything's fine. But, you know, if an Israeli, you know, at a demonstration were trying to crash through our borders and they're warned 1,000 times over, don't come close, and if they come close and they're suspected of being a terrorist, they're going to be shot at, and they shoot somebody, and a chayal goes, yesh! So that we're going to have to make an international uproar that a chayal applauded the fact that it, come on, you know, look, nobody's saying that that's the way chayalim should behave, but the double standards we all know. Yet we consider where we stand today in the international theater. We have diplomatic ties now with more countries than ever before, including official diplomatic ties with some of the Arab countries, and under the table ties with some of the strong Arab countries too, including Saudi Arabia. And, you know, it's only a question of time now that the El Al flights are going to fly over Saudi Arabia because they granted Air India and they know that they're going to be forced to allow El Al to do that as well. And what?
It's a lawsuit.
It's going to happen. There's no question it's going to happen. But it's in their interest. Saudi Arabia is working together with Israel on so many, many issues. You know, against Iran, listen, an enemy of an enemy is a friend, and the friend, and so on. So it may not be lishmo and l'shem avos Yisrael, but it does make a difference. We have interests that are common, and can you imagine that the strongest diplomatic ties in terms of friendship and assistance from European countries, who never were our best friends, but nevertheless were on our side at the UN most of the time, is Poland and Germany. Go figure that out. With all the, you know, the new laws that they want to put in, that's notwithstanding. Everybody agrees, both the Polish government and the Israeli government, that we have to keep this up. This is important. It's mutually beneficial, and so on. Poland and Germany are much stronger friends than even France and England. But nevertheless, you now have African countries with ties with Israel, and we are now marketing all kinds of technological assistance, agricultural assistance to African countries. This pays off at the end of the day. And the miracle of the political side that the Rav was hearing in 56, today it's tenfold, if not a hundredfold, over this miracle, because it's growing. And you know, if you remember the Ramban, the end of Parshat Bo, when he talks about miracles, so if you want to think which is the greatest miracle of all in the 40 years in the Midbar, so it's not the dramatic Kriyat Yamsuf, which you might expect, or something of that nature. It says man that fell for 40 years. So in the 39th year, a baby that was born in the desert, what's breakfast? Breakfast is opening up the tent door and pick up breakfast on the doormat. That's breakfast. It was natural. It was like gravity. Yet, think about it. In year 39, it was no less miraculous than day one. So the miracle just grew and grew and grew until it became natural. And that's why the Ramban says that Mother Nature is the greatest miracle of all. So this miracle on the political side is only growing. It's only growing, and it's growing in our favor. Look, I don't want to get into the domestic politics here of your president of the United States, but there's no question that when it comes to the policy vis-a-vis Israel, especially coming after Obama, we haven't had a better situation. And come Yom Yerushalayim, the embassy is moving to Yerushalayim, U.S. embassy, and it's going to bring along several other countries. We're not announcing which yet, but foreign ministry said there are about 10 other countries that are coming along for the ride, and that's very important, very important. And that's why, by the way, the Palestinians in Gaza are starting to make some trouble again, because they realize that their issues were not in the headlines for a long time, and they've been subdued, and everybody's worried about Syria and Iran. Hey, what about us? And Trump's getting away with this business of moving the embassy. So they make a little trouble. That's the rationale behind that. In the area of the second knocking, the military victory, here things have changed absolutely dramatically. Indeed, in 48, it was an absolute miracle. It was Rabban Biyad Ma'atim. Today, that's not the case. Israel has become a regional military superpower. There's no other word for it. Military superpower. Nobody in a million years would have forecast that this was going to happen in 48, but this is the case. This is the case. We have the firepower, we have the ability to thwart off. Now, obviously, we're not walking around with Kochi Votzim Yadi Asali at the Chayel Hazeh, and we recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu has got to be with us at every step, but it is very comforting to know that we have the manpower and the equipment, the know-how, to deal with major military situations, to the extent that in 48, the issue was what's called kiyumit. Are we going to exist or not? Today, that's no longer the issue, and the only element of that kind of a question is a nuclear threat from Iran, and that's why we're fighting tooth and nail that has to be put down. And as Rosh Hashanah said, and if the Americans don't do it, if others don't do it, we'll have to do it. And it was just announced now that we put away a reactor in Syria in 2007, and we dealt with Iraq, and so on. We're going to have to do it. That's no question. We'll have to do it. I think the Iranians know that we have the power to do it as well. So that's also reassuring. So on the stage of the military, It's just unreal. Remember, I mentioned in one of my shiurim that my son Eitan told me, Abba, this is not 1939. We have at our disposal today kelim mekelim shonim. And it's true. I remember when my son Eitan was in my high school, the yeshiva in Chashmonaim. So I used to serve the Air Force as a marzeh, as a lecturer for the chaplaincy. It was the greatest miluim you can have. All you do is get 40 shiurim a year in the Air Force, and that's called a year's worth of miluim. So at age 47, they threw me out because their computer missed me by 2 years. And I was in the middle of a sugya, and I protested. I'm telling you, I protested. I said, you can't throw me out now, So they said, you can make an irur, you can appeal it, it'll take 2 months, don't bother, So fine, so I was finished. But I told the chaplain in the Air Force base near Beersheba, Chatzirim, that was attached to that base, I said, listen, if you have a Yom Iyun and some rough can't make it, give me a call, I'll be happy to come down, gratis. Fine. As it was, a month passed by, and there I got the phone call already. So some rough from Bnei Brak couldn't make it, and I said, what time do you need it? And he says, 9 in the morning. I said, I'll be there 9 in the morning to give a shir, but there's a price. What's the price? I want to bring my son, he's an 11th grader, and he wants to get a tour of a squadron of the fighter jets. So he said, I'll call you back. Calls me back 15 minutes, sudar, it's arranged. You come, bring him a half hour early, you should go through military clearance. And fine, I give the shir at 9 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, a jeep standing outside the shul in the base with a chayal. And he tells my son, wherever you want to go, just no pictures. Okay, said no pictures. Where do you want to see? I want to see the squadron of the F-15I. I is the Israel, you know, the we take care of the F-15s when they come, and we make them the F-15Is. Fine. So, what?
Make them what?
We make them, yeah. So the commander of the squadron, we are VIPs, he gives them a grand tour, and he tells my son, he says, you want to sit in the cockpit? Now that was a big mistake to tell my son he died. I said, do me a favor, don't give him the keys. The keys. So and when you look at it, you look at this plane, and what it can do, it's reassuring, Baruch Hashem. It is reassuring. So this level, I mean, the Rav would look at the state of Israel today and this, phew. But you take even in the area of technology, the Rav many times over said, we need Bindinat Yisrael to revitalize and rehabilitate the world of Torah. That's what we're there for. Science, technology, the Americans, Western countries, that's not what we're there for. But as it was, we became a global superpower in high tech as well. So we've gone way beyond what the Rav anticipated could become Medinat Yisrael. But I want to focus on the theological. This, the Catholic Church did not recognize the State of Israel, as the Vatican does for all countries. They send ambassadors, and they have a foreign minister, and so on. Why didn't they do it? Because we know that the Catholic Church had a real problem, as all the Christianity had a problem. If Yeshu was, you know, the Brit Chadashah, the New Testament, so... how come there's still Jews around? It was a kasha, it was a question that they had. So there were three different levels of responses. To use the analogy of Mitzrayim and Shirat Hayam, there were those who went down Kakash and Ka'evin and Ka'oferet. Those who, the tzaddikim went down like lead without pain, and then there were those who went down like stone, so they bobbled a little bit, and those, the Rishoyim Gemurim, they went down like straw, and so on. The Catholic and the Church, they also had different levels of answering this question. So some felt that you have to annihilate the Jews. That's the mitzvah. That's what we have to do. And many, many generations, they fulfilled this lemahadrin. I mean, they felt this was the mitzvah they had to do. And even in days of the Shoah, there were no small number of Catholic priests who believed that the Nazis were doing the Lord's work. And, you know, and that's as simple as that. And then there were others, especially in the Middle Ages, who said, no. You don't have to kill the Jews. But it has to be very careful, clear, that the Jews are second-class citizens, and therefore they could not have the same level of rights and residential areas and professions. There are all kinds of limitations slapped on the Jewish people. With regard to residential areas, we have the rise of a ghetto. Ghetto, I'm not talking about the Warsaw ghetto. Ghetto is an Italian word. It means a closed-in area. That was a bracha for us, not a klala. That's why Yiddishkeit survived and flourished in Europe during the Middle Ages, because we were autonomous and we were able to develop, you know, spiritually, culturally, and so on. But this idea from the Catholic Church was to keep us on a low level. Well, that's all fallen apart after emancipation, and Jews are granted political rights all over the place. So the last stand of the Catholic Church was eternal damnation. The Jews will remain in Galut forever. They'll never go back to Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Now, the Reformed Jews originally, 200 years ago, they shared that platform also, by the way. They didn't call it Galut. They called it Or LaGoyim, or the Or Goyim from Yeshayahu. But they also believed that there was no Shivat Zion whatsoever. That was the official position of the Reform when in its inception. So the Catholic Church believed they would never come back. What happens in 48? Jews are coming back to Eretz Yisrael. It was a real thorn in the theology. And the Rav felt that this was very important. Very important. Because from our point of view, it's the downfall. It's the downfall of everything that they stood for. Now, you're going to tell me that 1994, the Catholic Church recognizes Israel. And there is an ambassador today. Oh, so they did tshuva? They didn't exactly did tshuva. No. What happened was, Oslo, 1993, Rabin HaManoch presents, comes up with this great Oslo agreement, which most Israelis and most Palestinians think doesn't exist anymore. But nevertheless, it was a signed agreement that, among other things, said that the question of Yerushalayim will be placed on the agenda at the end of the day, but it will be placed on the agenda for negotiation. Now, once you do that, you've basically surrendered at least part of Yerushalayim. Everybody learned the Mishnah in Shnayim Mokhs and Batalis, right? The best thing to come out of this is Yachloiku. Something's going to be divided. So the Catholic Church was trying very hard to also deny Am Yisrael the sovereignty over historic Yerushalayim. I'm not talking about West Yerushalayim, which was never historic Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, the old city, Har HaBayit, and so on. And the only way that they would be able to participate in the negotiations and the discussions is if they had diplomatic ties with Israel. Because Israel's ground rules are, you have to have recognition, or else you can't talk to us. So they were willing to bite their lip and swallow their pride and have diplomatic relations with Israel so that they should be available for these negotiations, in the great hope that one day, Israel's going to be a passing historic episode and they won't have to remind themselves. That was the reason that they did it. But Kadosh Baruch Hu apparently has other plans. And it makes one bit of a difference if the Vatican has an ambassador by us or not. But Am Yisrael has really shown the Catholic Church that it was wrong. Their theology is problematic, and they have great difficulty dealing with it. Now, they're the evangelists, they're a different parsha. So they believe that Yeshua will come a second time, but it's a prerequisite that Am Yisrael comes back to Eretz Yisrael. And that's why they're pumping millions of dollars into the country. So what's our attitude? All right, when Yeshua comes, we'll deal with it. In the meantime, divide, as they say, we're taking a lot of money. That's a Jewish way of seeing things. But that's really what's happening. So this is with regard to the theological. With regard to Jewish identity, so I don't know if you heard, Lauder just recently made a statement that we in Eretz Yisrael are responsible for a hitbolalut, for assimilation in America. So he was clobbered by everybody. I mean, how can you make that kind of a statement? We in Eretz Yisrael are responsible for assimilation? I mean, there was no assimilation in America before 1948. Everything was glatt kosher and everything. And the rationale that he offered, well, because there's an issue with the conservative reform, believe me, I also struggle with the issues of the conservative reform, but that's not something that's promoting assimilation in America. The Rav felt in 56 that for some Jews, it's going to be the last straw of hope of remaining connected to Am Yisrael, the state of Israel. They're going to have no connection to Shabbat and Yom Tov, to Torah Moshe, not even to Yom Kippur, but there's going to be something called the state of Israel that they're going to be able to hang on to, but Karnot HaMizbeach, as they say, and still keep them within the fold on some level of remaining Jewish from an identity point of view. Now, I believe that has only strengthened. You take, for example, birthright. The birthright was started by Steinhardt and who's the other one? The two Bronfman. So they were now in the 12th year of birthright, and statistics were actually done. So we know the statistics of intermarriage, the Pew reports, and so on. I don't know exactly how you measure, because I think the whole question was Miu Yudi here, who's Jew in the statistics there. But it's way over 50%. We know it might be 60%. The intermarriage rate. But they examined already those who came from birthright for the two-week trip and then went back to America and got married. What's the intermarriage rate? And they said that it dropped considerably, which means that it does impact the very connection. It wasn't just the 2 weeks that they were in Israel. The 2 weeks in Israel changed their lives in terms of their attitude of being part of the state of Israel. Many years ago, when I was still living in Beersheba, I was invited to speak before a little group of 20 Reform rabbis. Jews are Jews. I'm willing to speak to Reform rabbis. And I remember I speaking to them, telling them that in my humble opinion, you can take all your bar mitzvah programs that start from third grade to eighth grade, and you're spending 5 years trying to pump a haftarah, into their head, and then the kid comes to shul, and it's mocha chaydash, he prepared the wrong haftarah, So I said, what's going to last in terms of this boy's Jewishness? I said, why don't you forget about all that? When a boy's 13, bring him and his family to a three-week structured tour of Israel. And I guarantee you, this will have a longer, more lasting impact on his Jewishness than all the bar mitzvahs, anything you're going to put together. And they said there's something to it, but the other thing is they were going to be put out of business in their schools and so on. So I said, keep the schools, but do this. Promote this as a value. Not 13, bring him at 16. But you have to do this. Because you take, for example, since the Six-Day War. So the Six-Day War, you have so many boys and girls going to Israel after high school, after a year or two of college, whatever it is. So you know the statistics of Aliyah in the United States is not very complimentary. From the inception of the state in 48, the American Jewish community, all different brands of American Jewish community, has sent 1% of the American Jewish population on Aliyah. 1%, that's all it is. 1%. It's the lowest Aliyah rate than any other country in the world, percentage-wise, the lowest rate. The problem is, you live in Teaneck, you don't feel that because, you know, he went on Aliyah, and his children went on Aliyah. Right, because it's Teaneck, Beseda. And, you know, you go to Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, they're in Ramat Bet Shemesh, and they're in Hashmonaim, and they're in Ranana, they're in Efrat. So you think that everybody's capable of coming to Aliyah. No. Teaneck is a little bit of a cocoon, and so it's higher. We know that. But across the board, it's 1%. It's no more than that. It's mamash, no more than that. The question of Jewish identity, so they took the statistics of all the boys and girls who've been to any one-year program. It could be a kibbutz program, Mir Yeshiva, Hebrew University, whatever it is. And these fellows, boys and girls, went back to the States and started their lives. How many came on Aliyah eventually from this pool? The answer is 10%. So it's running 10 times higher than the national average. In my year in the Gush, it's 70%. My year, 1972, 70% of live in Eretz Yisrael. And that's okay, sad, so it was a good class. But it is extremely important. And to say that, and the Rav is on the money, that is, it connects you, deeper connection. Obviously, you can have a Torah connection, halacha connection, and so on. There's so many levels of connection. But even if it's just a superficial Zionistic connection, it's epis, it's something, it's very important. When the Rav talked about Dam Yehudi Eino Hefker, we saw this in Entebbe, for example. Entebbe, that's what the world really gave up. And here, Am Yisrael said, no, we're not going to give up. There are Jews out there, and they have to be saved, and we're going to save them. And I think today, there is a feeling amongst all Israelis for sure, and hopefully Jews throughout the world, that Jewish life cannot just be taken any longer. When you study the Shoah, obviously, there's examples where Jewish life was worthless. Jewish blood was worthless. Today, that's not the case. Something happens, so you may argue a little bit with government policy. And by the way, you know, in the Tefillah L'Shalom Amdina, that was authored officially by Rav Herzog, but the real author was Shai Agnon. We know this today. But Rav Herzog just gave the literary polishing at the end, but Agnon put it together. So it says, Ushlach orcha va'amitcha, you should send your guiding light l'rasheha, l'sareha, u'liyoatzeha, to the leaders, the ministers, the advisors. There's one word that's missing. What about toshaveha? What about its residents? Well, it already says yoatzeha. So that would be kefal aloshin. You know? It says yoatzeha, advisors. Which Israeli is not a government advisor? Everybody has what to say. So we criticize. Oh, they should have done this, they should have done that. But say that, you know, when you're not there in government, knowing all the facts and everything, it's very easy to sit in the sidelines and criticize. But the fact is, that practically every pigula, ultimately, somebody's captured. It's true that there was a very bad policy of sometimes prisoner exchange and murders were let out. That we know. And hopefully that's going to change. They're even making a law now that can't happen anymore. And it's very touchy subject of capital punishment, the good reasons for both sides, and so on. But the fact is, there's no impunity. You know, a machabel, a terrorist, knows it's only a question of time he's going to get caught. Because that's the way it is. If, God forbid, a Jew is hurt, somebody's going to be out there in the name of the Israeli government and catch the guy and put him out of business. And now they're dealing with the families of such mechablim as well. And, you know, blowing up a house, denying them entrance permits into the country, the whole family, work permits. So they should feel it. They should feel it that you brought up a son who's a mechabel. You know, you're going to pay the price as well. Dam Yudi Eino Efker. And the idea of opening up the gates of Yerushalayim, I remember the Rav said in this Kol Dodi Dafek, he says, you know, ayin tachat ayin. If you look in source number 9, so that's the whole question of Baba Kama. Ayin tachat ayin, eye for an eye, is not literal. It's a financial type of payment. It's compensation. But the Rav said, in this case, ayin tachat ayin mabash. An eye for an eye. I mean, he was a real hawk in 56. And the truth is, you know, the government basically says, yes, dam Yehudi eino hefker. The last idea has to do with opening up the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. In those days, he was talking about refugees, pleitim. There's hardly any more pleitim. No more refugees coming into Eretz Yisrael. The aliyah that's coming to Eretz Yisrael now is of a high-quality aliyah of people who are deciding to go on aliyah. Who didn't have to go on aliyah. Whether it's going to be, you know, from North America, even from Western Europe. So even though in France it's upgraded when there's more anti-Semitism going on, but nevertheless it's still a voluntary aliyah, and nobody's being kicked out of a country anymore. North African Jewry is already in Israel. Iraqi Jewry is in Israel. All these countries, Russian Jewry, any Soviet Jew that's in Russia is by choice, not because of design, any longer. So it has taken on a different slant whether you're doing it for the mitzvah, whether you're doing it because of nationalistic reasons, but it's a lot more positive than just saving your skin and your family, and we see this as an upgraded. But even with all this having been said, the idea of Kol Dodi Dafek, would the Rav today have delivered the same speech? That's a tough question. I have here a printout, just one line, one page, from last week's Makor Rishon. Last week's Makor Rishon, Rav Chaim Navon. He's a Gush guy. So many of you have read his books and articles. Was he here once? Rav Chaim Navon? He's a strong Talmud of Rabban Lichtenstein and so on. And he writes a lot about the Rav. He's put out books, him and Yuval Shurlo. Isn't that league? And so on. Well, Tova Lichtenstein told me 5 years ago at the 20th Yortzef in the Rav. So Tova says, you know, Chaim Navon and Shirlo, they never knew my father, and they're all talking about him and everything. He says, you and your brother, you knew the Rav, you know, it's a different story. She gave me a pat in the back. Okay, so what does he do here? He, ki'ilu, that's a great Hebrew word, ki'ilu. The whole country is ki'ilu, right? Ki'ilu, he's interviewing the Rav. He's sitting down. Yeah, no, somebody drew it. Some artist drew a picture of the Rav with Chaim Navon, and he's conducting an interview. And in this interview, for the 25th Yahrzeit, now it came out on Chol Hamoed Pesach. In this interview, he's like asking the Rav, you have to have a lot of audacity to think that you know what the Rav would answer these questions. Which, I think you have to be a little careful about that. But he said, now in honor of the 70th Yom HaTzmut for the Medina, he says, would you have given the same speech of Kol Dodi Dafek? Where was it? Here. He says, Hayita kotev hayom et ha-mamar tzioni ha-gadol shelcha. Kol Dodi Dafek? Hayita meshaneh mashu? Would you have changed something? And it's interesting that that he thinks that the Rav would have said that the emphasis has to be a little bit different. No, it's clear that he could not have given the same speech. That's for sure not. But he thinks that the Rav would have said that the basic thesis of what he said is still true. But he believes that we today have to focus more on the religious identity of the state. He says, we've done a lot. There's been, in the world of Torah, the Rav said he would have been very proud of so many yeshivot and so many learning programs going on. But the religious identity of the state has not yet been fully defined. It's still fluid, exactly how it's going to work with regard to issues of Shabbat, with the other issues, public issues, and he thinks that there's still some work to be done, and so on. Now, this is all Chaim Navon speaking. You know, he's trying to get out his ideas using the Rav as a mouthpiece, and I'm not sure how legitimate it is if people don't pick it up. because this is not the Rav responding at all. But I do agree with him that the Rav most probably would have adjusted the article in light of today, because there's something about the Rav that we understood. When people ask me today, what would the Rav have done today about such and such of an issue? The answer I give is, I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. The only thing I can say is, I'm absolutely sure that it did not necessarily have to be exactly what he said 30 years ago. That I can say for sure. Maybe he would have said what he said 30 years ago, but maybe he wouldn't. That's who the Rav was. But exactly what he would have said today, I have no any musad. Who are we to even suggest that we know what the Rav would have said? And you have to be very careful about that. Very, very careful. So the fact that, you know, we believe, and I believe it's absolutely true, that the Rav would reconsider in light of new developments, that means, do you have to necessarily be locked into every opinion that's recorded that he said in 1950, 1960, 1970? Most probably not. Most probably not. Because perhaps the Rav today would have seen it somewhat differently. But can we now quote the Rav and say, for sure not. You have to be careful about that. And I believe that the call of lo lachmitz et hasha'ah, don't miss the opportunity, is loud and clear today, in spite of the fact that we're doing so much better in terms of the population, the Jewish population. We're today 46% of Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. And in 10 to 15 years, we are Rov Am Yisrael Eretz Yisrael. Because of negative population growth in Chutz La'aretz, because of intermarriage, and because of population growth, which is positive in Israel, and Aliyah. 10 to 15 years. And that will impact halachically on many of the mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz, according to some of the Rishayim, not to be taken lightly. Not to be taken lightly. And let's point out that the last time Rov Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, which is defined halachically as Biat Kulchem, was 2,600 years ago, before the Galut of the 10 tribes. That was the last time. In Bayit She'ni, it was a dismal failure in terms of the ratio of the Jewish population in Eretz Yisrael as opposed to Chutz La'aretz. 5%, maybe. 5% of Am Yisrael were in Eretz Yisrael. The rest, as Rabbi Yehuda Levi says in the Kuzari, they were sitting in the comforts of their homes and their businesses and fields in Bavel, and there was a large Jewish community already in Egypt and a developing community in Italy already. They were not in Eretz Yisrael. And that's why there was, the Gemara says, that's why there was a second Korban. And to this end, the Rav was a little bit worried that we have to guarantee. I'm less worried. Because I see the handwriting on the wall that we're moving towards Rov Eretz, Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael. I think it's going to be a great day for Am Yisrael. And it's either going to happen in the delivery room, so maybe my daughter, who's a gynecologist and delivers babies, maybe she'll be Zoicha to bring the 50.00111% over the line, or maybe it's going to happen some nefesh benefesh, you know, flight coming in, and maybe, or it's going to happen, unfortunately, with a joint rabbi priest wedding in New York City that you read about in the New York Times on Monday, and another loss to Am Yisrael that will shift the balance in favor of Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. It's going to happen. And Kol Dodi Dofek, I believe, the call is still there for us to listen to and listen to it loud and clear. Toda Rabba.
He's the Rav sitting Rav in Dimona. He still is. He still is. Yeah. Susie told us. All right. Listening.
I need these buckles.
I've gone a few times.
By the way, yes, the car has an Israeli flag.
How many seats in the Knesset did the Mapai did Mizrahi have? How many did Aguda have?
Aguda very little.
That's what I mean.
Aguda very
little. So what's different today is that I think maybe the majority of religious Jews in Israel are not religious Zionists. In those days, the vast majority.
I don't think you can use the elections as a barometer because that even me, people.
I know
one out of four vote for
Okay, but what's your sense? So what's your sense, though? Would you compare to 1956?
Yeah.
In terms of
to physically be around Koto.
Could you tell us when you come in next time? Maybe we have to speak for a Muna. You think I'm kidding? You did not
She's
for
back.
Muna fundraising.
What did you go home last night?
Yeah.
She's still here. She's still here.
He's not still helpful. You were not helpful with my Emunah fundraising when he said that we don't need
Lindy's
it.
Lindy's Mishpacha.
Yeah, she told us.
Religious, came out irreligious, but then after some time was returning to Hashem.
I'm talking about the 1%. We still are
around
to give an enormous amount. We still are around an enormous amount. But we're going to go to the next one.
Yes, yes, yes.
Not say that we don't need the money. We need the money.
You guys are working.
We need the money.
How long is that?
We need the money. What they give
I'm way too old to go to the kind of thing we went to last night. I mean, Dover's adorable. They're an adorable couple. Kid's a great kid. Did you hear how they laid it out?
No.
Your table number at Romer.
The table number was in years that the Asians, Rangers, or Giants. And you were a world champion. I was a 19. You are here at my district. And the whole theme of what happened, this was sort of the table number, so go to the table.
And while it's an important part of it, you know, these things will resonate, that's not what it's about.